Case number 08-1379. Michael Frederick Siegel, petitioner versus Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Freeman for the petitioner, Ms. Potts for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is George Freeman. I'm here today on behalf of Fred Siegel, who is here in court with me. Mr. Siegel has appealed the SEC's order on three grounds. I want to focus this morning on two of those and touch on the third if time allows. I want to focus on the orders of restitution and suspension. The SEC faces an insurmountable hurdle with respect to both. Why? Because both are punitive, and because the law prohibits the SEC from imposing any sanctions or rulings that are punitive rather than remedial. Let me take up the issue of restitution first. The SEC has ordered that Mr. Siegel pay restitution to the customers involved. $400,000, $300,000 to the Downers, $100,000 to the Landrys. This order is punitive for at least four reasons. The first is it's not restitutionary at all. In this context, restitution would require disgorgement of any benefit that Mr. Siegel received.
That's usually even the definition of restitution. Right? Restitution is getting back the person who lost money, the money they lost. It doesn't necessarily, it may or may not be money that went to the person who caused the loss, but restitution doesn't necessarily mean that it has to have been a one-for-one trade.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that under the Knudsen case and others, restitution ordinarily does require some form of disgorgement. Otherwise, the remedy is not restitution, but instead compensation. And restitution would require that the
compensation doesn't sound punitive either, frankly. So I'm not sure what you call it, but I don't understand why giving the victim back the money that the victim lost constitutes necessarily a penalty.
In this context, Your Honor, compensation would be punitive for several reasons. First off, in order for Mr. Siegel to be required to compensate the customers in a way that isn't punitive for him, he would have had to have caused their loss. Okay. He did not cause their loss.
That's a separate question. If I burn down your house and the court orders me to pay you back the cost of the house, I got nothing out of your house. But is that punitive if they order me to pay back the value of your house rather than simply compensation or restitution?
It wouldn't be restitution in that circumstance, Your Honors. I appreciate it. It would be compensation, but
would
in that particular instance,
would it be punitive?
Not in that particular case, Your Honor.
So does the whole argument then come down to causation?
It does not come down solely to causation. It also relates to the affirmative defenses that would apply here, Your Honor.
Well, your point is that these two individuals or couples, whatever they were, and number one, got material that indicated to them, and their testimony is that this was a very risky proposition they were getting into.
And they, yes, sir.
Yeah.
And they otherwise conceded, Ms. Landry did, that this was like going to the boats and gambling, putting your money in a slot machine.
The company did not succeed.
That's correct.
And their losses were caused by the company's lack of success.
That's correct.
Right. And I guess you're saying as well that the SEC and now FINRA agree that a but-for cause is not sufficient to impose this kind of liability on somebody.
Well, I think the SEC and FINRA both take the position that but-for causation alone is sufficient. We would disagree with that, Your Honor. We would argue that loss causation or proximate causation.
I thought I recalled at some point in the SEC's brief they concede that but-for causation is not enough. I mean, that's got to be the case because, I mean, otherwise the parents of Mr. Siegel could be foisted with liability because but for their actions, he wouldn't have introduced these individuals. He wouldn't even be here, right?
Your Honor, if but-for causation is not enough, then you have to prove proximate cause. They cannot prove and have not proven proximate cause in this circumstance. I appreciate it.
Isn't the heart of your argument on the money that we're putting in a restitution label is it doesn't satisfy notions of loss causation, which the agency appears to concede are embodied in their own regulations. They have not satisfied the principles of loss causation. They cannot show.
That is definitely our point, Your Honor. I don't believe they've conceded, though, that they must prove that point.
I'm saying they conceded that the regulations, as I'm reading, and I'll question them. You don't have to answer for them. It appears to me their regulations embrace loss causation.
That is my understanding, too, Your Honor.
If they do, I don't know how this gets there.
I agree, sir.
Tell me how I'm not clear about the intersection of this proceeding, which began with FINRA, and there are a couple questions I have about that, and the arbitration proceedings. What's the timing? First of all, what's the timing and what is the interplay between those two proceedings? The arbitration was brought by the
customers, the Downers and the Landrys.
Right.
The arbitration was brought immediately after Mr. Downer's lawyer wrote an extortion letter. Nobody's disputed. It's an extortion letter to Mr. Siegel saying, if you do not pay this money by 11 o'clock this morning, Mr. Downer has authorized me to take this action to my son, who is the local district attorney, for prosecution purposes. Shortly thereafter, the Downers and the Landrys, friends, filed an arbitration. Actually, they filed a lawsuit. And then Mr. Siegel and others filed a motion to stay pending arbitration before FINRA, which the district court granted. So we had the arbitration. Along a parallel track,
the arbitration resulted in?
In an award in favor of Mr. Siegel, which the Downers and the Landrys took to the district court, then to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit affirmed the award.
Can I ask you two questions?
Yes, sir.
But that was based only on statute of limitations, all right?
It was based on statute of limitations.
Not on the merits.
Not on the merits, but, Your Honor, if I may, having participated in that
particular... No, you have to tell me something in the record I can rely on.
It is in the record, Your Honor.
Tell me.
In the record from the...
Is there something before us that we can look at on this?
It's going to be in one of the record excerpts from the arbitration proceeding. The argument for the statute of limitations was, and it was a critical component as to which statute of limitations applied, and it was whether or not a recklessness or fraud standard applied on the one hand, or alternatively, a negligence standard. Mr. Siegel was only entitled to prevail on statute of limitations ground if the panel determined that it was a negligence standard, which the panel did determine.
When you come back on rebuttal, could you tell me the joint appendix page where that is? Because I couldn't find it.
Yes, sir. I will look for that, sir.
Okay. And then the second question is, I understood from the NASD rules that the decision on arbitration doesn't preclude NASD proceeding at all. It has no preclusive effect, the arbitration. Is that right?
Their contention is that it has no preclusive effect, Your Honor.
Not their conclusion, their rules. Rule 10-105, quote, the submission of any matter to arbitration under this code shall in no way limit or preclude any right, action, or determination by the association which it would otherwise be authorized to adopt, administer, or enforce.
That is its rule, yes, Your Honor. But it may only apply its own rules in a way that do not result in punitive.
Oh, no, I have that.
Yes.
I understand. But there's
yes.
Nothing preclusive in the way that a fact-finding by some other agency.
We would like to argue that, Your Honor, but we cannot argue that.
It's just nice for you to know you didn't lose an arbitration, but that's about it.
No, no, sir. We would contend that the arbitration is highly relevant both to the restitution order and to the suspension order. And it's relevant because it goes to the fairness of requiring compensation in these circumstances.
Tell us why you think getting the monetary award or restitution, the consecutive suspension, is punitive.
The consecutive suspension is punitive for a couple of reasons, Your Honor. One is that the SEC has ignored, as did the National Adjudicatory Council, that in the 12 years since Mr. Siegel engaged in the private securities transaction at issue here, his record is spotless. It also gives short shrift and says it's not relevant at all the fact that during the almost two decades before that, his record was spotless. So for almost 30 years,
They don't take short shrift. They say that spotless means we don't increase the penalties, I mean the remedies, but it's not, it doesn't reduce them. That is, past bad acts can enhance, but they don't mitigate.
They say the past bad acts, yeah. Prior to the events in question. They did not take into account, Your Honor. In fact, they argue we have waived the argument that they need to consider the conduct of Mr. Siegel since 1997. We have not waived it, Your Honor. If you look at page 38 of our SEC brief, we raise it explicitly. We raise it explicitly in our initial brief and in our reply brief here. That was front and center before the National Adjudicatory Council and the SEC, that they should not ignore in determining what a remedial sanction is that Mr. Siegel has engaged in only one instance in his entire 30-year career where he violated the rules.
Can I ask you about on the loss causation question?
Surely.
I take it he concedes that he never even read the materials with respect to this company. Is that
right? He expressly told the Downers and the Landrys that he had not read them, would not read them, as a way to impress upon them, Your Honor, that they needed to do that.
And assuming you lose on the liability question, not the remedy question, he could not have recommended this to them, right? He could not have.
Had he read it, Your Honor, and known the contents of it, he could not have recommended it to them.
And is there any evidence in the record that other things that he could have recommended to them and that would have recommended to them would have had the same loss consequence? In Bastion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, hold on. And just for one second. In Bastion, there was evidence in the record that they were going to invest in oil and gas and that everything in oil and gas had gone down. Is there evidence here that they would have invested in it, something else equally bad, regardless of, that is, equally bad that someone could legally have recommended to them?
Yes, Your Honor. Two pieces of evidence. The first piece of evidence is, if you look at the transcript testimony of Mrs. Landry and Mr. Downer, when they were talking with Mr. Siegel about the particular investment, she said she was willing to invest 10% of her assets in something that was comparable to going to the slot machines. So what Mr. Siegel could have done here, sir, since these were discretionary accounts.
That doesn't mean that she was going to do that. I mean, she was willing to take a risk, but she also, in the very same statement, which is at JA-603, she says, but let me tell you the thing that reinforced me was that Mr. Siegel says very confidently and competently, I might add, and very trustworthy, and we had all the confidence in the world in the gentleman. So she wasn't saying, unlike the evidence in Bastion, that if I didn't get this one, I was going to go to another one. She wasn't saying that I was going to take it to the casino. She understood it was risky. But is there any evidence of something like Bastion where they were intending to invest in this sector? Is there any evidence like that at all?
There's no evidence like that, Your Honor, other than their statements that they were willing to take substantial risk with a small portion of their money, but not to invest particularly in this investment.
Or an investment like this, which had half of the words not filled out.
Oh, but, Your Honor, I think that's a different issue. Whether they were willing to invest in a startup company, the FINRA all, itself.
Yeah, but all startup companies aren't the same, right? Some startup company, it may be true that across the vast, looking at hundreds of thousands of startup companies in a statistically significant sample, many of them fail, but every startup company isn't equivalent risk, is it?
Well, every company is not of equivalent risk, Your Honor, but if you're looking at the statistically significant sample, which is what I would suggest you should look at, that's the most appropriate thing, you see 90% of them do fail. And these folks, the FINRA itself stipulated, before we ever went to the disciplinary hearing, that an investment in this sort of thing is something they would have considered would have been suitable for them, but not in world itself, but a speculative investment would have been perfectly suitable for these individuals.
I want to follow up on that. The two charges against your client were selling away, right?
Yes, sir.
But selling away really has nothing to do with the restitution order, does it?
In this context, I understand that it does, Your Honor. Yes.
How can that possibly be? Because the only if sawing away only requires the consent of his of the company for which he was working, right?
It does.
That doesn't go to the
written consent.
To the restitution. I don't understand how. I don't see any nexus between that. But let me go on because maybe the SEC will tell us where the nexus is because I fail to see it. But the second was that this was an unsuitable investigation or an unsuitable investment. And there's kind of a whipsaw there because if in fact he didn't believe he was recommending it, the SEC saying, look, if you're going to sell away, you better do it right. You better really get deep into this material. You better read it. You better give advice. You better call these people in. If you're going to sell away, you know, we want you to do it 100%, right? Not to skim the surface.
Right.
But the question I have is, what was your defense to the unsuitable investment charge?
The defense was severalfold, Your Honor. One was that a recommendation was not made, that Mr. Siegel went to substantial.
That goes to the sawing away, too. Yeah.
Right. Well, actually, sir, he went to substantial lengths to try to convince the downers that they shouldn't make this investment initially at that particular time. They should wait until the company went public. This conversation arose when he's going to meet with them, and they're talking about a wide variety of things, not just their investments. Ms. Downer conceded Mr. Siegel did not come there to talk about the world investment. They were talking about Mr. Downer's bid for to become governor of the state of Louisiana. They were talking about his National Guard activities and his desire to.
Your time is up, and I know you'll get time for rebuttal, but I thought I heard you say that you. Maybe I misheard this, but are you conceding that this was an unsuitable investment for these people?
What I'm conceding, Your Honor, is that the investment, because of the deficient documentation, was unsuitable. Not that it was unsuitable for them to have invested in World ET.
You're talking about one of the two clients, right?
For both of the two clients, Your Honors, the documents themselves.
I thought you were conceding the point as to one and not the other. Is that right?
With respect to recommendation, the recommendation.
I thought with respect to fitness, though, separate that from recommendation. I thought you conceded that this was not
one of them.
Both of the customers were fit for a speculative investment in a startup company like
World.
For the downers, what the SEC found, based on the NAC's conclusion, is that Mr. Siegel had made recommendations to both. We are contesting the finding of a recommendation to the downers. We don't believe there's a factual basis for contesting that a recommendation was made to the Landrys. There is a basis for, there's no basis
was
for.
Was it unsuitable because the documentation was not up to snuff, or was it unsuitable because the company was such that it's not something anybody should have put any money in? Which is it?
Unsuitable because the documentation was not up to snuff. Mr. Siegel, however, may not be held liable for an unsuitable investment unless he recommended it. Well, he did not recommend the investment here.
And so my follow-up question is that if the documentation was poor, was it poor in the sense that it lulled these investors into thinking they had made a secure investment, or was it poor, so poor that any fool with any investment experience reading it would know that they're rolling the dice here?
The latter, sir.
Did you challenge that? I understood that you challenged whether there was a recommendation.
That's correct.
But you did not challenge whether it was an unsuitable investment. Am I wrong about that?
We did not challenge, Your Honor, the fact that the investments the Downers and the Landrys made based on this particular documentation was unsuitable for any investor.
Did you make any claim that it was suitable for some other investor?
It was not suitable for any investor, Your Honor. This documentation, it was so bad that no reasonable person, having read it as Mr. Siegel encouraged the Downers and the Landrys to do, would have invested in it.
Think of the worst that could say, put your money with us and you're going to lose it, right? And they put their money in anyway, right? Well, I mean, does that mean that that Siegel is responsible for their loss because he didn't read that piece of paper?
No, Your Honor.
Well, I don't get it. The SEC will explain it.
Did you raise below an argument that it would have been suitable if it hadn't been for the missing language? That is, that there was something about this investment that made it suitable.
We did argue below, Your Honor, that an investment in World ET would have been suitable for both the Seagulls and, I mean, the Downers and the Landrys. We never disputed, though, Your Honor, and I don't believe in good faith can dispute, that these two particular investments, given the documentation they made, were suitable for anybody.
And on the recommendation question, our review is only for substantial evidence, right?
Well,
our standard of review. The SEC decided that you did make a recommendation, and our standard of review is only whether there's substantial evidence for that, right?
Yes, sir. That is my understanding. What the SEC has ignored, two critical points the SEC has ignored, are the fact that these were discretionary accounts, and I'll be glad to explain that, although I may need to do it in rebuttal, and number two, the accredited nature. The fact that these were accredited investors, that Mr. Downer in particular, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, Chairman of the Budget Committee, Chairman of the Appropriations
Running
Committee.
Out of your rebuttal time.
Sorry, sir.
We'll hear from the SEC. Let me just say, I'm sorry, Mr. Freeman, if you could find that joint appendix citation for the arbitration relying on the recklessness. I still haven't been able to find it.
Yes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Radha Potts and I represent the Securities and Exchange Commission. I'd like to step back for a minute and talk a little bit about the facts because, Judge Randolph, I'm not sure that, in fact, you have an accurate understanding of the facts. This is a case about a broker who engaged in reckless misconduct. Motivated by his own interest to preserve the appearance that he was not selling away from his firm, he recklessly induced his customers to purchase debt securities that amounted to no more than the issuer's promise to repay if, as, and when the issuer might choose. The one way he decided that he could avoid selling away was by doing the one thing that would maximize the risk of harm to his customers, and that was he chose not to read the offering materials. Now, besides being illogical, his insistence that he demonstrated that he was not recommending the securities by not reading the offering materials, the problem with that is, by that time, he had done everything he could to encourage and facilitate a sale. I'm not going to repeat the facts about his very active role in this.
He did everything he could to facilitate the sale?
Yes, Your Honor. Because although he stated to, we will concede that he stated to the.
I can think of a number of other things he could have done. He didn't do everything he could.
Well, he.
He did a lot of things.
Okay.
He's satisfied with that.
Although we will concede that he did say to the Downers that, you know, they shouldn't invest just because he was investing. And although he said to them that there might not be an opportunity to invest until there was a public offering, he nonetheless found an opportunity for them to invest, and he nonetheless allowed them to follow his lead. And
you mean allowed them?
In other words,
coerce them.
Well,
this is not like Damsho, where you have a cold call on a retiree who is not aware of what's going on. These people were sophisticated. They knew what they were doing. They had the papers, and at least one of the couples waited a long time before they finally acted.
Well, let's talk about that, Your Honor. Hunt Downer, the testimony is very clear, was a man who delegated responsibilities. He was a man who relied on Siegel unequivocally. So when Siegel expressed his enthusiasm for that company, that was enough for Mr. Downer. Now, you may think that was reckless for Mr. Downer to, you know, rely on Mr. Siegel, but in fact, those are the facts. And let's look at Dottie Landry, the woman who Mr. Siegel claimed was one of the smartest women he'd ever known. They're both wealthy, yes, but she testified she did not even know what a debenture was. So these are not the sort of sophisticated investors that one would think of.
Well, the record just doesn't come across that way. It really doesn't. When you look at cases like Damro and some of these other cases, it just, and you know, I look for other SEC cases where you have imposed, where you might have imposed a situation where you've got to look at Judge Posner's analysis on loss causation. At least I have to make any sense out of this. This doesn't come close to loss causation. We have a situation where you have investors who clearly are prepared to invest in a speculative, no doubt about it. They make it absolutely clear. They have a long history of investing. They are sophisticated. They were not pushed. It's not like Dambro where it's a cold call and they're pushed. And I can't find a single case. And I looked at the couple that were cited by the SEC. There's no case where you have required the offending party to pay the entire loss. There's not one. None of your cases, there are three of them that you cite. None of them support that. There's just nothing in the agency's jurisprudence to suggest that this satisfies loss causation. Nothing.
I think the Faber case, the $82,000 that was required to be paid in Faber, was the full amount lost.
What about do your decisions have to be consistent with the NA? Well, it's now FINRA. Suppose FINRA has a whole line of cases, right? And they go one way, and on restitution. Case comes up to you, and you render a decision that's totally inconsistent with all those FINRA decisions on restitution. Are you bound by them in any way?
To the extent that the sanction guidelines state...
They're FINRA's sanction guidelines, right?
Right. But to the extent that these sanction guidelines are consistent with the statute and people, you know, would look to them and they would supply a standard for, you know, any given relief, to some extent. But, you know, if the commission decided that those guidelines were inappropriate, the commission could deviate from them.
Let me ask you then. You've got... Given the SEC says, given that Siegel was the first to identify World ET to the customers and the significance of his involvement, we conclude their losses were a result of his recommendation. I don't see how you possibly can square
how you get
that
there.
with the Mark Love case.
Well, you can't square it with. Let's go back to Faber. Here's what the SEC said. They did what they did because Faber recommended that a financially inexperienced customer of modest means preparing for retirement invest nearly all of her portfolio, which constituted more than two-thirds of her total liquid assets, in a single speculative security despite her instructions that she wanted conservative investments. Okay. That's precisely my point. There's no case in which the SEC has required someone to pay the full loss where you have sophisticated clients who wanted to speculate. There's no case.
Okay. First, the difference is that this case is not about a recommendation that was unsuitable for the particular investor. This case is about a recommendation that was unsuitable for anyone, period. So the other cases...
That's because on the face of it, it appeared to be incredibly risky?
That's because on the face of it, it amounted to... what was essentially an unenforceable promise to repay at an interest rate you didn't know what it was, on a maturity date that was differently stated in both of the downers' documents. And finally, there were no repayment terms given. Now, it's right that you would think that any fool would know that this was not, you know, something to invest in. But as I said, Dorothy Landry, they got their account 1 year prior to that time, Judge Edwards, with Siegel. Prior to that time, she'd invested only in CDs. She did not know what a debenture was, and although she was experienced in the biomedical field, she did not know about finances. They relied on...
She was willing to shoot craps or whatever it was that she said.
Yes, she was willing to, you know, Your Honor, I would also point...
Words, but
look at page 8, where initially what Siegel did to invest their funds was to put all of them in chicken stocks. And why? Because Siegel considered these stocks to be safe, stable, controlled investments consistent with the Landry's investment objectives. Now, he said he would tell them. He would tell them about an opportunity to make a more risky investment. And that's what he did. And they relied on him. They were not going out and saying, oh, I have to risk my money on any investment. He came to them with this proposition, and they relied on him. Simply because you have money does not mean you are a sophisticated investor.
How do you distinguish this case from Love? The broker was selling away, and his clients, he put them into terrible, risky investments. They lost $690,000, and he wasn't ordered to make restitution. How do you distinguish?
One, he was only charged with a 30-40 violation, not an unsuitable recommendation violation.
It was a 22,000-something.
If it was a 2010, that's the basic sort of you cannot engage in unjust and unfair
practices. He wasn't charged with making an unsuitable recommendation in that case.
He was not.
Right, only was selling away.
Right.
So that's a violation of his responsibility to his employer, but not a violation of his responsibility to his client.
Right. That's why Love is off the top distinguishable.
Did the SEC rely in any way on his violation of 3040 in imposing the restitution sanction? If so, it's inconsistent with Love, then.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, and I'll tell you why. To the extent that the conduct, the selling away conduct, was a recommendation, yes. But really, it was about the unsuitable recommendation. And if you look to the page in the commission's opinion about why. The critical issue on restitution here is the page in the commission's opinion that talks about why they ordered this. And essentially, it was that
698.
It was just to have Siegel bear the burden of the loss rather than his customers. And why was that? And so now I'd like to go back to well, first, I'd like to say something briefly about the consecutive sanctions.
Before you do that,
go ahead.
There's an element of a conflict of interest here as well, isn't there? He was hired by this company to gin up business.
Okay, let's talk about then restitution, because that flows directly into my argument about restitution. The sentence that I pointed you to, Your Honors, is really the heart of the commission's opinion. And what it does is it harkens back to a line of cases that are exemplified and cited to in Gordon versus Burr and Pitcher versus Dahl. In fact, it uses the same language as a case called Peterson versus McManus. Now, those cases and the authorities they cite all circle back to one place, and that is Restatement of Restitution First, Sections 142 and 143. And essentially what they establish is that where an agent procures a payment for a principal, and the agent here would be Siegel, the principal here would be World ET, when they do that and they have knowledge of a ground for restitution, then the fact that they don't retain a benefit or even obtain a benefit in the case of the Gordon case does not mean that they cannot be ordered to make restitution.
That's fine. That makes sense. The Reed cases certainly suggest that, but it's beside the point. That doesn't address the question about loss causation.
Oh, but I think
it just doesn't. The fact that in some cases, that's what Judge Garland started with the opposing counsel in the very beginning.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some cases in which you may end up paying more. Yes, that's right. But that's kind of a so what.
Your obligation here is to explain us the difference between this and Bastion. Can you do that?
Okay, yes. One. There is no proof that these customers were intent on making a risky investment any risky investment. There simply is no such proof. They were willing to listen if and when Siegel approached them with an opportunity. Two, this is not necessarily a case where they were willing to assume risk, yes. But as Dorothy Landry put it, I was not willing to see an investment that was going to vanish, that was going to go poof. And why did this investment vanish? Why did it go poof? Because it had none of the attributes of a debt security.
What's the commission's distinction as opposed from your argument?
In terms of loss causation?
In their opinion, where is all this?
They don't say what you're saying. The commission doesn't, and we can't affirm the commission or sustain them on grounds that they're not mentioned in their opinion. And what you just expressed to us,
I would
you agree that what you just argued is not in the commission's decision?
And I want to reemphasize it because the first thing I did in preparing this case after I had it all in head, I read Bastian. It's a compelling argument. I went back to the commission decision. I don't see any line of analysis that plays it out the way you're trying to play it out now. None.
Okay. I think it is in there. If you,
I think it's a page and a half, and they blow it off.
If,
and they don't cite any of their own precedent that supports it.
Okay.
Nothing.
First, they would say that loss causation in this context, that loss causation drawn from Bastian would not be appropriate, and I would agree with that.
Where are they saying it in their decision? Where are they disposing of the question that a Bastian analysis
raises? The first thing that they do is they say that Bastian is inapplicable on page 21, because they say that it is an instance of a private action for damages under the anti-fraud provisions. That's
right.
The first
so that
thing.
That didn't help me at all because it's the line of thinking that I'm worrying about.
I understand. The next thing is that in footnote
55.
Thank you. The text that accompanies footnote 55, I think, indicates this, that the commission is saying that but-for cause is certainly needed, but that a little bit more than that may be needed depending upon the case. And you know what that harkens to? Vaknin. There is a very interesting discussion of causation in Vaknin.
Is Vaknin cited?
It's actually cited by the other side.
Is it cited in the opinion?
No, but it harkens, this discussion, in my view.
It also harkens to but-for, right?
Well, no, because it says that there are many factors that can bear on a loss, right? And I think that what that is saying, that there can be concurrent causes of a loss, right? So they're not going to require that it necessarily be a direct or last cause, but they are going to require that it be a substantial cause, one that has some factual and temporal.
What caused this company to fail? In listening to you, I think to myself that suppose it were a manufacturing company, a startup manufacturing company, and it was risky, and this guy got them to invest, and then lightning struck the plant, and they lost all their money. Now, but for his advice, they wouldn't have lost the money. But of course, that's an act of God intervening. The paper that they signed, or the paper they were given, didn't cause their loss. What caused this company to fail?
In fact, I think that what they got was nothing.
No, but what caused the company to fail?
Well, it was because it couldn't raise enough funds, apparently, to continue to pay its royalties to this Amazing Concepts LLC. And that happened by October 98.
Well, that wasn't Mr. Siegel's fault, was it?
No, but what Mr. Siegel's fault was to ignore his basic requirement as a broker-dealer to recommend only suitable securities to his customers, thereby inducing them to make this investment.
I want to go back to the question which is expressed in about the third or fourth paragraph of the opinion, that Siegel was hired by this company to raise money.
Yes.
By fundraising.
Yes.
By this kind of capital attraction, right?
Yes.
And that seems like a significant conflict of interest issue, not just somebody recommending or not recommending a bad stock.
He would say that he did not sell securities under this agreement. That's what he would say.
He exposed that, right?
I'm sorry?
He revealed that, right?
Revealed that. Oh, okay. In terms of what he said to the investors, there is evidence that he did say to the Downers that he could not sell the security, and evidence that he said to the Landrys. Now, you have to understand that
any testimony that he told them
that he was not
required to engage in fundraising activities in connection with, among other things, fulfilling a quote $200,000 commitment close quote and operating capital.
I don't believe so, because he signed that draft agreement was given to him December 6th, so it would have been after the Downer's investment, but before the Landry's investment, and there is no, and the NAC credited, excuse me, the panel credited only the Landry's testimony. So looking at the Landry's testimony, the easiest way to look at it, there is no evidence that he told them that he was hired to raise funds. He did say he might have a future IPO, I think.
Did the SEC rely on a conflict analysis? Conflict of...
I think it was important to the commission.
Did the SEC, in its opinion...
Yes.
Because, I mean, if I was writing it, I'd know how to write it just the way Judge Garland just wrote my first paragraph, and I'd keep going. Is that in there anywhere? I missed it.
When it discusses the aggravating factors, Your Honor,
yeah.
It talks about the fact that he stood to profit in a number of capacities, which is on page... 691, JA 691, Siegel claims he did not receive or expect financial benefit. However, his activities on World's ET's behalf had the potential for monetary and other financial gains. So, yes, Your
Honor. That's it.
Well, but that...
Well, no, I mean, it's very different from what Judge Garland was beginning to pursue as a line of not just nail in the coffin. This bill's a coffin. That's not what the SEC is doing here. They respond to one of his arguments by saying, well, you know, he also may have profited. That's it, right?
No, actually, that is an aggravating.
Well, I'm just asking, yeah. Is it there or not?
That's on page 15.
Yeah,
where they're explaining why they affirm the NASD. They
right.
say the NASD identified several aggravating factors.
Right.
Siegel sold $400,000 in world securities. He was affiliated with World as a director and employee. He attempted to conceal his sales activity by failing to inform his employer, changing his address.
That's a 30-40 violation.
Well, yes, but these are aggravating factors.
But it's under the 30-40 violation, and I
that's true, but he makes an unsuitable recommendation in part, I think, because his firm is not supervising him. So, you know, while the conduct is different, while the conduct that violates 30-40
is 2310?
2310 is the unsuitable recommendation.
The very first sentence, the second paragraph of that says, NASD found aggravating that Siegel attempted to conceal his misconduct from his employer.
Right.
So that they're
right,
they're relying
on
the same for both.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because it impacts on that conduct.
Can you state for me in a succinct way what the commission's standard is for when to order restitution and when not to?
Take the elements that are listed in the guidelines, that there is a quantifiable loss sustained by an unjustly sustained by an identifiable person.
No. Quantifiable loss as a result of the respondent's misconduct.
Right, and that was the third.
That takes you right into Posner's.
The third, as a result. As a result doesn't say proximately caused. It doesn't.
But four, we've already conceded that.
Well, only just a little bit more than that, because that's what that footnote appears to indicate.
What does that mean, a little bit more?
Well, a little bit more maybe that he sold them something that was worthless by not reading it, by not doing the things he should have done. I guess my time is up, but...
All right, I think we've run out of time.
Okay.
In fact, way over time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll hear rebuttal now. How much time does he have? No time. I'll give you a minute and a half. How's that? And part of that time, I hope you're going to show me the part of the arbitration where it says something about recklessness.
Your Honor, I checked for the specific record excerpt. All I could find in my brief review there was if you look at footnote 5 in our original brief, what it points out, and I apologize for not being able to identify for you. I'm confident it is in the record, the arbitration decision
brief,
itself.
I couldn't find any record to support what you said in your brief. That's what's troubling me. I don't mean troubling, but I didn't find anything.
Well, let me – footnote 5 basically sets it out, Your Honor.
Of your blue brief?
That's my understanding, yes. Footnote 5 of ours, is that not it?
Yeah, in making this finding, the arbitration panel found the limitations period did not exceed. Is that the
– Correct. That's it, Your Honor. Yes.
There's no citation to the –
JA 606, whatever would support, we don't think it does, but it's JA 606.
All right.
That would be the – thank you. And the if I may, Your Honor. If you look at that, you'll be able to see the basis for the arbitration panel's decision. It's highly relevant here, both to the restitution and the suspension, in that, as SEC's counsel acknowledged, the relief here is designed to protect somebody who has been unjustly deprived. When the arbitration panel finds that neither of these sets of individuals is entitled to a dime, it would in fact be unjust under these circumstances to make Mr. Siegel pay. Part of the affirmative defense of statute of limitations, it's a substantive defense. It's designed to...
Well, this would take us into extremely unexplored territory. Has any court ever held that an arbitration...
No, Your Honor. I have not found that, Your Honor. Let me address another point you raised, and that is about Siegel having a conflict of interest. If you look, Your Honor, we are focusing here, as to the recommendation issue, on the Downers. We have had to concede, based upon standards of review, that it doesn't apply to the Landry. So the recommendation issue goes to the Downers. The unsuitability recommendation goes to them. The alleged conflict did not arise until after the Downers had made their investment, Your Honor. Mr. Siegel did receive the documents in early December. He didn't sign them until later, and it was an obligation he assumed if, in fact, additional monies were to be raised. And his understanding always was, it's uncontradicted, that he was not going to be raising any money until this company went public. He understood that that was going to be happening at some point.
That's not what the SEC's opinion says.
Oh, the SEC, but there's no factual basis whatsoever for the SEC's conclusion on that, Your Honor. He specifically told the Downers that he encouraged them to hold off investing until after this went public. And then he testified, it's uncontradicted, that he expected it to go public at some time, I believe it was in early 2000. That did not happen. He expected it within a matter of weeks of having signed the agreement. He took no action whatsoever at any point in time to raise any additional money. So the conflict arose after, and it is unrelated to the original recommendation.
Time at which they were had a chance to withdraw?
Pardon me, sir?
It was a time at which they had a chance to withdraw their money, right?
I don't recall the specific date of the discussion about whether to put the money in World ET or the mothership.
Yeah.
Right.
Was that after or before?
I don't know that the record shows the exact date of that, Your Honor. The money went to World ET. I don't think there's any dispute about that. It was transferred from their account at Dane Rauscher, went to World ET, both the Landrys and the Downers, and World ET used that money for purposes that didn't turn out to be profitable. The reason World ET failed is because it lost its licensing agreement with the company it had gotten the license from. That's in the record.
No further questions. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Case will be under submission.